Okay, so this is a recap of what we were talking about last time. We started this new topic on file systems and I/O. Okay, so we have presented this picture which says this is how the file system component of the kernel looks like. So there's an interface that any file system exports to the application of the user. That interface uses system calls. Okay, so there are calls to manage files, there are calls to manage directories that are not shown here. This is how applications interact with the OS to access files. Excuse me. So the other thing I mentioned is typically application programmers don't program at the system call level. Okay. You do this only if you want high performance or there's a special reason you're not using any of the higher level libraries that are available to you in any language, be it Java, C, C++. Okay. So typically you interact by calling methods or functions in the library. The library actually invokes these system calls for you. Okay, but you should know that they are there, and that's how typically anything in user space interacts with anything in the kernel, okay, as far as I/O is concerned. So there is the other thing to keep in mind is there are two parts to any file system, a device independent part and a device dependent part. The device independent part does not worry about what kind of hardware the data lives on. Okay, it presents a more generic interface to the application. The device dependent part, typically this requires device drivers. Okay, it could be a disk driver or it could be a USB thumb drive driver or a CD-ROM driver. So that's the component that's actually interacting with the hardware, okay, where your data is stored. So you could have different kinds of hardware, magnetic disks, solid state disks. They could be CD-ROMs, which are read only, write once, read many devices, USB drives, the whole spectrum of the storage devices. Okay, we only looked at one so far. Okay, so this is the part that is actually interacting with the disk. So all the calls that are coming in get translated to device-specific calls. The device driver makes the calls to the hardware. The hardware either reads and writes data and then sends interrupts back to the kernel. Okay, this is the picture to keep in mind. So last time we talked about this component. Okay, the device independent part is specifically the interface that is presented to the program. Okay, so I want to, there were two slides that didn't cover. Okay, so we looked at file operations, so quick slide on directory operations. Today we'll have more to say about directories. There are files or system calls to manage directories, just as there are system calls to manage files. So you could search for a file. Okay, so that basically says here is a file name. Does it exist in this directory? If so, give me the handle for that file. You could create files, which modifies the directory. Whenever you create a file, you have to add an entry to the directory saying this is a new file, it has this creation time, this is the user who created the file, that's the size of the file. All of those entries, all of that metadata gets added to the directory. When you delete a file, that entry gets removed from the directory. Okay, so anything that you do with files also has an implication on the directory that contains the file. Okay, so the directory data also gets updated. Okay, you could list a directory. If you do ls or dir in Windows, you get a list of all the files contained in your directory. Okay? You could rename the file, you could traverse the file system. So whole set of operations that the directory supports. Okay? And last but not least, there are methods to enable sharing of your data. Okay, this is referred to as protection. We will come back to this. Okay, there's an entire chapter in the book on protection. I will come back to that and discuss that in more detail later on. Okay, but just to give you a feel for what you can do, typically given any file, okay, you can control who gets access to the file in addition to the owner of that file. The owner can specify who else gets access. Okay, there are two ways to do this. Okay. Is what is called the access control list, and there is access control bits. Okay, this and there are different ways to address the same problem of specifying sharing. Access control list, also called ACLs, allows you to specify sharing on a per user basis. Okay, you can specify in addition to owners names of users and what operations they are allowed to do on the files. Okay, this is a list. that you have for each file in your system. By default, okay, the actor will only have the name of the owner and the operations will be all. So owner can do whatever he or she wants. Okay? But you can add other users. So you can say your friend, let's say user ID foo, can read and write but not execute. Okay? So you can specify this. You can specify the name of another user, specify read. You can add this. This is referred to as an access control list. It's a list that specifies what users have what kinds of access rights on this file. Okay? If you have any experience with Windows, you will realize that this is the Windows way. Okay? This is basically what NT and XP and Vista, this is what they support, okay, in terms of file sharing. Okay? So every file and every directory in your system has this access control list. Okay. Now, another way to think about it is if you do Google, for instance, or Google Docs, right? So that has an access control list. If you turn on sharing, if you create a Google document and you say, I want to share this, you can share by specifying a list of users, right? So that's exactly what an ACL is. So every file or every document there, you can specify this list saying, I want this person to only view it, I want this person to view and modify it. So you specify these rights, okay, on a per file or a per directory basis. Okay, is that clear? Now, so on the one hand, this is very flexible. You can control for every file exactly who gets access to that file. Okay, so it has a lot of flexibility, but on the other hand, this list can get large and tedious to maintain. For every user you want to provide access, you have to specify the name of the user. So if you have thousands of files and you are trying to manage sharing, you will have to basically deal with this issue that each file has its own list. Okay, so it can be large and tedious to maintain. Unix uses a different approach. Okay, Unix has any Unix like operating system allow sharing, but you do not get this granularity of sharing. So what happens in Unix is all users in the system are divided or partitioned into three groups. Okay, so there is the user or the owner of the file, there is something called a group, this is the group that the user belongs to, and then there is everyone else, which is also referred to as world. Right? So there is this partitioning created for a file, saying all users fall in one of three bins. There's in the user bin, there's the owner of the file. Okay, this is exactly one. This is the owner. Okay? When you create an account for that user on that machine, typically he or she gets assigned to a particular group. Okay? So this group will have an arbitrary number of users. Okay? So you can specify access permissions for the owner, you can specify access permission for the group that this user belongs to, and then all the other users on the system belong to this other group called world, which is everyone else. Okay? Unix allows sharing only by at the granularity of these three bins. Okay, you can't do anything more fine grain. Okay? So for the user, you can basically specify read, write, execute permission, saying what is the owner allowed to do. Typically, the owner has full permission and can modify the permission as he or she wants. Okay? And then for the group, you have three types of permissions. Can you read the file? Can you write to the file? Can you execute the file? Okay? And the same for everyone else. Okay, is this clear? So basically you have three categories of users, owner, group and world, three types of access privileges, read, write and execute. Okay, so for each of these three bins, you can specify the read permission, write permission and execute permission. Okay. So on the one hand, this is a lot less flexible than the ACL model, because if you wanted to provide access to only some people in your group and not others in your group, you cannot do that. Okay, because it's all or nothing. Either you allow access to the entire group or no one in the group. You can't say I only want to provide access to these three people in the group.
So you can put those
people in a different group. That's what I was going to say. So the only way to do this is to now construct a new group that has only those users, and then change the group for the file itself. The group can also be modified. Okay, you can change the group for the file and then give the appropriate permission. But as you can see, for every possible subset, Okay. You, this becomes very tedious to maintain. If you have a group of n users, there are 2 to the power n subsets possible. Okay. You don't want all of these groups to be floating around. That makes it a lot more complicated. Okay. So it's less granular than the ACL list. You can do whatever you do in that case by constructing a group of exactly those users. And all users in that group get exactly the same permission. You can't say, I want one user to get only read permission and the other user to get read-write permission. That you cannot do. Okay? Because you can only plump these two users in the same group and then give them whatever permission you want. You can't do those two things. Yes, question.
So, when the last one is finite control, but they
can
say, Unix also allows you that control if you're willing to have a large list of groups.
You can do it if you have a large list of groups, but that said, there can be only one group per file. Right? So if you have two categories of users, okay, so owner assume has full privileges. If you say, I want this group to have only read permissions, only view, this group to be able to read and modify, you can't do that. Because there can be only one group per file. Because beyond this group, then there is world. There's everyone else. Okay, so if you say I have these two categories and they need different types of accesses, there is no way to do it. That's the point. Yes, you can create groups, but everyone in that group, and there's only exactly one group per file, you allow some access. If there are two different or n different kinds of users with n different or groups with n different types of accesses, it's not possible. Okay, so less granular. Okay, works well in practice because not like for every file you have very special needs. Sometimes you do. Okay. It's the advantage though is that this is very efficient to maintain. Okay. Here the access control list can be of arbitrary size. So the metadata for access control can be arbitrary in size. Here the metadata is exactly 9 bits. Okay, because there is 1 bit for each type of access. Okay, so is 111, the first 3 bits say read, write, execute bit for the user. 1 says you have that right, 0 says you don't. So this says that the user or the owner has read, write, execute permissions. Next 3 bits are for the group. So it says anybody in that group can read, nobody is allowed to modify, and you can execute. Okay, so these are the read, write, execute bits for the group, and these are the read, write, execute bits for the world. In this case, no one else has any other permission on this file. So you can store the entire access control based information in 9 bits. So this is very efficient. Okay, so it's also you know exactly how much space is needed. Okay, it's 9 bits, no more, no less. In the ACL, it can be arbitrary. Okay, on a per file basis, you can have arbitrary size lists. Okay, is that clear? Okay. So now, because there is this limitation in Unix. That has by default any Unix file system will have an access control bits for the file, but the limitation, as I said, is less granular in terms of control. Modern file systems, okay, let's say modern file system Linux, they by default they will have access control bits, but you can additionally add access control lists to each file. Okay, this is not created by default. Okay, by default you will only get this, but if you want to provide some additional access, you can attach an ACL to that file. Okay, so in other words, modern versions of Unix actually do both. Okay, this is done by default. Additionally, for a per file basis, you can specify this. So if you have a ext3 file system on Linux, for instance, okay, this is what you will have to log into the EdLab. Okay, those file systems by default will do this, but they also allow you to actually do specify access control lists and what. Okay, Windows only does this. Okay. OS X by default, because it comes from the Unix heritage, does this. Okay, nothing, it cannot do that. Any questions on this? Yes. Yeah. So, what you are asking is a slightly different question. You are saying, how should you set permission information so that certain users can do certain things. So by default, most systems will have privileged users, also called administrator, super users, there are different terms, and non-privileged users. Privileged users are allowed to add programs or modify system files. Non-privileged users can only modify files in their own directory, they cannot modify system files. This is a predetermined grouping that the operating system has. But you can then relax that and say non-privileged. If you want a non-privileged user, let's say, to upgrade Flash Player, what you can then do is go to the directory where Flash Player is stored for that user, the programs and settings in that directory. And then change the access control information there, because typically that user will not have access to write to that directory, which is why they cannot upgrade. Upgrade means you are actually overwriting some files and deleting old files. Because that entire directory prevents you from doing that. For all non-privileged users, you cannot do that by default. But you can go and add those modify the access control list to get whatever you want. So it is possible, but administrator has to set that. Once the administrator does that, then you can go ahead and do it. That's
is the reason why
why don't they do it? So I think there are default policies that the operating system might provide. The default policies and environment may have decided. Okay. So in the Unix world, by default, if you are not a super user, you cannot install programs, period. That's the way the Unix world has always been. There are users and there are administrators. Anything that requires you to install anything requires administrator. Anything that does not, user can do. And then there are old versions of Windows, for instance, did not have this notion of different types of user. Any user could do whatever they want. So which means that users by default have full privilege. They can go wipe out the operating system. You can do RM and the kernel is gone. You can't boot from this point on. So typically this distinction exists so that non-technical users do not go inadvertently go and delete something or modify something they shouldn't. So there are users who know what they are doing, so they are allowed to do this. So that's the philosophy that the operating systems platforms have. OS X is sort of a hybrid. By default, when you create a user, by default you get administrative privileges, which means that users are allowed to go and write into the applications directory and modify files and so on. But you don't have to do that. You can create a user with normal access, in which case they will not be allowed to do that. And this is done with permissions. I can show you, for instance, how this works. So it depends is the answer. Now, why does UMass not do that? That's a different question. Okay, they probably have just adopted the default policy that comes with Windows or whatever platform you are talking about. Maybe it was Linux. Okay, but it can be changed. You can always change the default. So just to show you, you may be digressing a bit, but I can just show you what. Okay, so you'll see that the applications for directory there is owned by root, that's a privileged user, and then the group there is set to admin. Okay, and you look at the permission, it says the root in this case. So you see that the root can do whatever he or she wants, read, write, execute, it's fine. The group can do read, write, execute, but the rest, which is the rest of the world, you can read the directory, you can execute programs in that directory, but you can't write. Okay, the write bit is off. Okay. So only users that belong to the admin group can actually install new applications on this system. This is the default policy. Okay. So now if you want to know if you can do this, what you do is you go and check your permission. Okay. So now this is my user ID, that's my username. I belong to this whole large number of groups. Don't ask why. But the important question is, am I in the admin group, which I should be somewhere. So you will see that this user is actually part of this admin group. If you are part of that admin group, that says you are privileged to write into this folder. okay, because this folder has a group of admin. If I belong to the admin group, I can write to it, which means I can download new programs and I can install them. I can upgrade Flash Player, because Flash Player resides in that directory, for instance. Okay? But when you create a new user, you can say, is he or she an admin user? If you say no, then you will not belong to that admin group, which means you can't go and write to this. Okay? This is how policies are set. Who can do what? Okay? So you have permissions on folders and your users who belong to different groups, and by belonging to different groups, you get certain privileges. Okay? This is how most operating systems will work. Okay, so does that answer your question? It's a long-winded reply to what you asked. Okay, so now we'll actually move on what we wanted to do today, which is file system implementation. Okay, so what I will do is talk about how this, so we will take one device, which is magnetic disks, as an example. Okay, in 2 or 3 years, this lecture is going to be redundant, because nobody will have magnetic disks on their machines. Everybody will be in a solid state world. But nevertheless, it's still interesting to understand how magnetic disks work, okay, and how file systems are optimized for magnetic disks. As you go through this, I will say something about solid state disks, and you will realize that file systems that are actually designed to work on these devices may not necessarily work as well on solid state disks, because they need a completely different set of optimization. The layout is different and whatnot. So as the world moves from magnetic disks to solid state disks for your laptops and desktops and whatnot, okay, file systems will have to evolve, okay, because they made certain assumptions about the device where the data is stored on. Those assumptions will no longer be true. Okay, so they will have to then make new assumptions and adapt the techniques that are used in there. Okay. So to understand how file systems are optimized for magnetic disks, we first need to understand how magnetic disks work. Okay. I actually meant to get one, but I forgot to pick it up. So I'm going to draw a picture to show you. Okay. So if you take a typical hard disk on any machine, okay, so a single hard disk, the way it is organized, it has a set of these platters. Okay. And these platters are spinning. Okay. Each platter looks exactly like a CD or a DVD. It has a recordable, it's basically a recordable medium where you can store bits. Okay. So you have this set of platters. Each platter has a read-write head. Okay. So that's the thing that's actually reading and writing. So this is where the data is stored. This is the thing that's reading and writing data from that platter. This whole thing is spinning all the time. Okay. If you have a typical disk, although it might be very small, okay, it might have up to a dozen of these platters all inside the disk. Okay. So, to understand how this works, we can just take a single platter, as is shown there, and try to understand how it works. So, that's basically what a typical CD also looks like. Okay. That's the platter, that's the recording surface of the platter. The disk is when you sort of try to read or write to it, this thing is spinning, and then there is this read or write arm. It's called read write head. Okay, so the way data is organized on this thing is you have data recorded on this thing in concentric circles. Okay, these are called tracks or cylinders. Okay, so you have these circles, and then there is data recorded on this. So you have the ones and zeros being written on this. Each track has portions called sectors. So as is shown here, okay, so these circular things are called tracks or cylinders. Okay, the term is synonymous. Each track has multiple sectors. Okay, so you can see that this track has 6 sectors. Okay, so each sector is typically 512 bytes. That's the smallest granularity of data that you can read or write from this thing. Okay, so each of this has 512 bytes of data recorded on this. Okay, so the way this thing works is sectors are numbered, tracks are numbered. So let's number these 0, 1, 2 and so on. Okay, and then within each track your sector 0, sector 1, sector 2, sector 3 and so on. Okay, so what you send off to your disk, okay, the command that you send to the disk is go to say a cylinder, or let's say just track 3, read sector 5, okay, or write sector file. This is the kind of IO command you are going to issue to this disk. Okay. Typically you will have platters as well, so you will actually say platter number 2. Okay. Because there will be multiple platters, so you will actually specify a platter and specify a track on that platter, a sector on that track. Okay. And now the way the disk is going to work is this. Remember that this thing is continuously spinning. First the disk head. Okay. The disk head can only read what is directly underneath it. Okay. So the disk head has to first move to the right track that you specify. Okay. If it's, let's say, somewhere here, the disk head is actually going to have to extend itself. So let this is the track we care about. It has to move, so it actually gets positioned on this track. Okay. This operation is referred to as a seek. Okay. So the disk head is just moving back. So the disk head can move back and forth and can position itself anywhere. Okay. So you first say go to track 3, and the disk head moves and positions itself on track 3. Okay. Once it has positioned itself on track 3, okay, you still cannot read the sector you specified because you have to wait for that sector to spin by under the head. Okay. So if the sector is presently here, you have to wait until this disk rotates and it actually appears under the disk head. Okay. Once it has appeared under the disk head, then you can read or write bits to that sector. Okay. So what does this mean? So this means that to do any IO, there are two kinds of waits that are incurred. The first is for the disk head to be positioned on the right track. This is referred to as seek time or seek latency. The next is, once you're positioned on the right track, the next is you have to wait for the sector you care about to spin by under the disk head. This is referred to as rotational latency. You're just waiting for the disk to rotate so that the right data appears under the disk head. Okay. So once you have incurred a seek and you have incurred a rotational latency, then the data that you care about can actually be read and written, and the actual time it takes you to read or write a sector is referred to as transfer time. Okay. That's the only useful work that the disk did. The rest of it was all waiting. You are just waiting for the disk head to position itself. Okay. So the response time for a disk is essentially the seek plus the rotational latency plus the transfer time. Okay. This part is essentially wasted time as far as the disk is concerned. Okay. Because the disk is not doing any IO, it's just moving the disk head or waiting for the thing, the right data to spin by. This is the only useful work that the disk is doing, actually doing IO. Okay. So you will see that a lot of the optimizations in a file system relate to optimizing the seek and the rotational latency. You do placement of data so that you minimize this part, so that you can maximize the actual throughput of the disk, maximize the actual amount of data you can read or write to the disk per unit time. Okay? So a lot of file systems have been optimized with this model in mind. Saying that data is going to be stored at arbitrary location. To do any IO, you have to first move the disk head and whatnot. So if you can minimize disk head movement, you are going to have better performing file systems. Okay. The reason I'm mentioning all of this is SSDs or solid state disks basically don't have any of these assumptions. Okay. A solid state disk basically looks like this. It looks like memory. Okay, so it's basically a set of pages where data is recorded. Okay. There is no moving parts in a solid state disk. Okay. So essentially it's a fully random access device where you can just say go to that block and read that block, and it just goes and reads it. Just exactly like RAM, you say go and read the contents of this memory location. The same is true in a solid state disk. Okay. So what this is saying is, a solid state disk, random access is very efficient. You can just jump around wherever you want on a SSD and read whatever data you want. Okay? And the latency, there's no latency, there's no seek latency, there's nothing like that. You just issue a command and then the controller just reads from that location and returns the result. On a magnetic disk, random access is going to be slow. Okay? Because every time you move, so you read this, now you want to go somewhere else and read that data, you have to move the disk head all the way to the inner tracks. Okay? And then again incur this rotational latency and whatnot. So that means that random access is slow because your disk head is just moving back and forth. Okay? Sequential access is fast. Because sequential access is, once I have read this sector, I'm going to read the next sector and so on. So in sequential access, there is zero seek and zero rotational latency. Because the data is contiguously stored, so once you start reading, you keep reading until you read the whole track. But random access is not. In an SSD, both random and sequential access are equally fast. The SSD doesn't really care. Okay. So this is all the file systems that have been optimized with these assumptions in mind. Okay. May need to be redone for these kinds of devices. They will work, but the optimization they are doing as far as placement of data is concerned may not exactly give what you expect in this case. Okay. That's something to keep in mind. Any questions on this disk layout? Okay, so I mentioned the overhead. The overhead consists of seek time and rotational latency, and then there's a transfer time, which is basically the amount of the time it takes you to read the data. So it's important to remember that the transfer time depends on the rate at which the disk is spinning. Okay, because the faster the disk is spinning, that says that I can read this much data faster. Okay, so you have disks that run at 3600 RPM, okay, rotations per minute, and then a disk that go at 15k RPM. Okay, clearly this disk can rotate faster. It has a faster motor, so it spins faster. Okay, so that also says that for this much data to spin by, it takes less time. Okay, so the disk can read and write faster. The disk head can read and write faster. So the faster the disk spins, less is the transfer time for a given chunk of data, because that data spins by fast quickly, and the read write head is also capable of reading and writing that much data faster. Okay? So the only way to improve transfer time is to make the disk spin faster. Only way to reduce this overhead is to optimize the layout of data on the disk. So you incur fewer seeks or smaller seeks. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so I already said this is what disk look like. Okay, they have a bunch of platters, bunch of read write head. At any given time, only one read write head can be active. Okay, so it's not like these are reading or writing in parallel. So you can only read, because this is all connected to a single bus. Okay, so you can have only one read write head active, and that's the, once you have specified which platter you care about, this head has to move back and forth, position itself on the right track and read data once the disk the sector spins by.
So is there actually space in between the platters?
Is there space in between the platters? There is very little space. Okay. Modern disks also do dual layer recording, which means they can record on the top and bottom to double the capacity. Okay. The other important thing that I didn't actually mention is modern disks actually don't look, this is what old disks used to look like. Okay. As you can see, here the number of sectors on the inner tracks and the outer tracks is the same. Okay, the inner track has in this case 6 sectors, outer track also has 6 sectors. Okay, but the outer track actually has more space. Okay, it's a larger circle. Okay, so what that means is here bits are packed more densely, here the same number of bits are packed more sparsely. Okay, but the disk has ability to actually store more bits here. Okay, so what is done in modern disk is the number of sectors, okay, varies as you go to outer tracks. In this case, you will have more sectors here, which means the disk is actually packed more, the sectors are packed more tightly. Okay, so this is effort of non-uniform recording of data. Okay, is that clear what I just said? Okay, because there's more space. So this is just showing you what old is in modern disks. This is how you actually have disks that can store more and more data. Okay, one simple thing is, as you go outer, go to outer tracks, store more sectors, not just keep the 6 sectors. You can actually store maybe 12 sectors. That circle is as a circumference as twice as much. So you can do these kinds of optimizations. Okay, any other questions on this? Okay, so you already mentioned any. So this is what happens. So you specify, I want to go to file, give the file number, and you say, I want this block. There is some mapping that says this block is actually stored here. Okay, platter 4, cylinder 3, sector 8. So then you issue this, the device driver actually issues this command to the disk. Then the disk does what we just said. It does a seek, there's a rotational latency, and so on. Okay. So as far as access patterns are concerned, like we talked about this last time, Okay, the file system needs to support both sequential and random access, because we said that file accesses could be either sequential or random, okay, when we were discussing this last time. Okay. So then the question is, what data structures do you need to maintain to do this mapping? This is very similar to a page table. It says this is the, these are the blocks within the file. This is the location on disk where it is stored. Okay, files, as you can see, don't have to be stored contiguously. Just as pages that belong to a process are not stored contiguously in RAM, same is true of disk blocks for a file. Okay, so you have to figure out what data structure you need to do that mapping and what policies you use to allocate blocks to files. Okay, that's basically what your file system does for you. Okay, so it has these data structures, it has these policies to decide how to do the layout. Okay, so there are some assumptions, not assumptions, but observations that we will use to decide what structures are going to work. Okay, so the structure that is used to describe where the file is stored on disk, we will call this the file descriptor. Okay, in the context of Unix, this is called inodes or index nodes, if you have heard of this term. Okay, but more generally we'll just refer to it as the file descriptor. Okay, so we have to understand how to create the file descriptor, what data structure to use, what layout to use. Okay, these are some assumptions that there are some observations that are true of most disks, okay, most data, not all but most. Okay, so observation, first observation is most files are small. Okay, second observation is most of the disk space is taken by large files. And then the third observation is IO operations are going to access both small and large files. Okay. So let's go to this observation. So the 90-10 rule applies, or 80-20 rules, whichever one you want. So what that says is 80 or 90% of the files are very, very small. The median size of a file on disk tends to be around 2 kilobytes. Okay, so if you just do an inventory of all the files that are stored on your machine, you'll see, and then you take a mean or take the median, see that the median is very small. But there are lots of little files, there may be configuration files that have a few bytes and so on. Okay, so most files are small. Okay, now that said, most of the disk space is taken by large files. There are some files that are large, but they are very large and they take up most of the disk space. Okay, so 90% of the files are small, the remaining 10% of the files take up your remaining 80 or 90% of the actual space. Okay, so if you think about this, so if you have a lot of files, so most of these files will be small, but you may have movies or images or things like this, which may be megabytes, gigabytes in size. Okay, those take up most of the space on your disk. So if you actually do the calculation, you will find that this is true of most disks. Okay. Now your file system needs to support accesses to both small files as well as large files. So what data structure should you pick that allows you to optimize your performance for these observations? So that's the question. Any questions on this? Is this clear what I said? Okay. So here is what we want to do in terms of designing our file system. Per file cost should be low. Okay, because most of the files are small, so if you pay a lot of overhead to access this file, 90% of your accesses will have a high overhead, which you don't want. Okay, and yet, when you do access these large files, okay, movies or whatever you have, maybe it's a rip of a DVD, you still want to see good performance. You don't want the performance of large files to be very bad. So you have to balance this tension. Are you going to optimize your system for small files? This is the common case. Or large? The answer is should be neither. You need good performance. Okay. You can have slow degradation, but it should still be good. So what should we do? Okay, so we look at several policies and several data structures. Okay, there are two things here. Okay, so there is basically index structures that your file system maintains, that's the file descriptor, and then there is the layout policy, which is how the data is actually stored on the disk. Okay, so both of these you need to decide based on these observations. Okay, so first we'll talk a little bit about this, then I'm going to talk some about this. Okay. So just to give you some notion of how the disk layout actually works, not the file system layout. Let's assume that this is a linear map of what your disk looks like. That's not the physical layout, but let's say these are blocks 0 through n. That's the typical layout of a disk. You have in the first block, you have what's called a master boot record. This tells you how many partitions you have on disk. Your disk may actually have multiple partitions. Each partition will have its own file system, for instance. And then after the master boot record, you have partition info, which says partition 1 starts here and partition 2 starts there and so on and so forth. And then you have these partitions that you've created of arbitrary sizes. Now each of these partitions is what we are talking about. This is basically an independent file system. This could be your C drive, for instance, and that could be your D drive. You have sliced your disk into two partitions. This could be a completely different file system. It doesn't even have to be the same file system, and so on. So what we are really talking about is what is going to reside in here. These other things already exist, and we will not worry about them. Is that clear? Any questions on this? Has anybody created partition? I'm sure you must have done this. You must have at least reinstalled your OS once. Okay. All right. So this is what the file system looks like. And typical layout, this is the physical layout. These are not policies. Typical layout looks like this. There is this some data that the metadata rather that the file system keeps. This is these three things, and then there are the actual files and directories that are stored here. This is the majority of this partition. So small part is essentially these three things. So there's this thing called a super block, which my, then there's a free block list, and then there are file descriptors or all of this metadata that I was talking about. So there's one file descriptor for each file on disk. So the free block list tells you which of these blocks are free and which ones are available. The super block is just where all of this information is stored, saying this partition is of this size, this is where the free block is list is stored, this is where the file descriptors are stored, and the rest of the disk is where data is stored. Okay? The question we are trying to really ask is, what does this data structure look like? What does this data structure look like? And how is this space managed? That's this space is managed by the layout policy. These two data structures are basically this part of the file system. It's the metadata for the file system. It says what blocks are available, what blocks are in use, and for each file, you have an entry there which says what, and we'll talk about that. That's the file descriptor. Is this clear? Any questions on this? Okay. So we will talk about this as we go along, but one thing to keep in mind is these data structures are created at formatting time. When you format your disk and you create put a file system on that disk, these data structures are allocated at that time. They cannot be changed typically once you have created the file system. What that also means is that depending on how much space you reserve for this part of your file system, which is where you store the file descriptors, there is, as I said, there is one per file. There's some amount of space you have to pre-allocate to store the file descriptors. Depending on how much space you allocate there, that places a limit on the number of files you can store on that partition. Once you run out of file descriptor entries in this space, you cannot create any more files. Is that clear? What I just said? The number of files you can store within a partition is actually determined at file system creation time. When you format the file, because at that point you say, okay, I will actually have 100 or maybe 10 megabytes of space to store my file descriptors. Each file descriptor, as we'll see, has a certain size. So depending on how many file descriptors you can store in this part where you have allocated space, that's the maximum number of files you can create. If you actually exceed that, there will not be any more space to store file descriptors. Your file system will say no more space. Okay, so you have to keep that in mind. The other thing, of course, is you fill up all the data part. You just use up all of the disk space, and then again you cannot create any file. So there are two restrictions. One is how much data you have, how much data, metadata you can store on the file system. That determines how many files you can create. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so now let's talk about some layout policies. The first one, this is, as you will see, mirrors somehow the discussion on memory management. Okay, so the first layout policy is contiguous allocation. So here the OS maintains an ordered list of free blocks. Okay, whenever you want to create a file, you allocate a contiguous chunk of free blocks. Okay, and then you basically only store the start location and the size in the file descriptor. Okay, so the file descriptor, I'm going to erase some of this. At this point, we'll only worry about this partition, so we'll just take. So that's your partition, okay, which we'll just call disk. These are file descriptors. So these are disks. So when you create a file, you allocate a contiguous chunk of disk space, and in the file descriptor for the file, you have a start pointer, which says this is where the file starts, and then you have a size, which is basically this. Okay, so file is stored contiguously in this case. Alright, so advantage of this approach is very simple. Okay, so you have a very simple file descriptor. This data structure, this metadata is not very complex. You just need to say where does the file start, what is the size of the file, that's it. Okay. Then you have to ask, is this efficient from a magnetic disk perspective? Okay, if I have to access the entire file, all I will incur is one seek to the beginning of the file. And then the data is actually stored contiguously. So in the context of the platter, this data essentially, this is the start location. And then you just keep recording. Okay, once you run out of track, you go to the next track, you keep recording. And so on. So data is actually stored contiguously. So all you have to do is seek to the beginning and just keep reading data continuously. Okay. So if you have to read the entire file, this is basically very efficient from an access time perspective. Okay. So you'll have one seek and one rotational latency to access the whole file. Okay. If you want to access parts of the file, then this doesn't matter. Okay. This is a large file and you want to access arbitrary portions of the file. If you're doing random access, then contiguous doesn't give you a huge benefit, okay, because you're jumping around in the file. But if you're doing sequential access through the whole file, then this is very efficient. Can't get any better. Is this clear? Now, if this was an SSD, you wouldn't care. I mean, sequential access, random access is all the same. Okay, because there is no latency or no overhead to read any data. You can go wherever you want and read. Okay, so that's the thing to keep in mind. Okay, what's the disadvantage? First disadvantage is, what if the file grows? Okay, typically you may create a file, let's say it's program code that you've written. You go edit it, you add some more code, the file has increased in size. Okay, in this case, this file would have to grow. If there is free space for it to grow, that's fine. If not, then contiguous allocation will not work as is. So you will have to take this entire file, move it somewhere else where there is more space for that file. Okay, so as the file's size changes, okay, you may have to do more work if there isn't enough space for this file to grow. Okay, and you'll, as you can imagine, just as you had in contiguous memory allocation, contiguous disk allocation, you have the same problem. You will have fragmentation, you will have holes. As you create large files, as you delete them, you will be left with all these holes. Okay, and after a while, you will have enough free disk space, but no hole that may be large enough to accommodate a file. Okay, then you have to go and defragment. Okay, if you had any experience in early versions of DOS or Windows, you remember there used to be some defragment tools you could get. Okay, that's what they used to do. Okay, because a lot of file allocation would be contiguous, they would move this data around and reclaim all these holes that were left. Yes, so old versions of file systems actually use this. IBM OS 360, 40-year-old file system. Okay, CD-ROM still use this. Okay. In a CD-ROM, you have contiguous allocation because it's a write once medium. You can write only once, so when you burn the CD, your CD burning program actually constructs the layout. Okay, if it's a CD with 10 files, it will just lay out those 10 files sequentially and write them out. And you just have a very simple file descriptor. Since this is not going to change, this works very well. Okay? So it is still used, but only for certain kinds of devices, which is CD, and then, as I said, early PCs, DOS and similar flavors use this technique. Any questions? Okay, so now we will look at something more interesting. So the next allocation is basically store files as linked lists. And no longer contiguous. So what we will do is we will assume now, okay, that the disk is basically a sequence of blocks of fixed size. Just as we had fixed size pages in memory, we will make the same assumption. We will say that this disk is essentially a set of blocks. Let's say the block is 4K in size, it could be 1K, 4K, some number. Okay, so you have these blocks. Okay? So now what you do is for every file, you will have this organization. You will have a file descriptor, which is at, all file descriptors are stored at the beginning. Okay, so in the file descriptor, you store the name and so on. And then you will keep a pointer to the first block of the file. So you will keep the address saying this first block is platter 4 cylinder 20 sector 5. This is what you will store here. Okay. This is the first block of the file. So the last few bytes of that block you will actually store to keep the next entry. Okay. So this is saying that the next block is this platter 271 and so on. So this is a linked list organization where each block contains some data for the file itself, and then the last few bytes are reserved to store a pointer to the next block of that file. Okay. So what does this do for us? Yes. Yes. So no need to do things contiguously. Okay, because these are pointers, these blocks don't have to be physically close to one another. They can be anywhere on disk. Okay, because all you're doing is saying this, you store an entry here, and this one will point here, this could point somewhere here, and so on. So you can basically just take any free block and allocate it to a file. Files no longer need to be stored contiguously. Okay, what other observations can we make about it? Incidentally, this is what the FAT file system uses. Okay, this is what came out of DOS. By default, if you have a USB thumb drive, if you don't reformat it, that comes with some version of FAT. Now it's called FAT32. This FAT file system, which essentially FAT stands for file allocation table, okay, that uses this organization. It's a linked list organization. Yes. Right. So we can ask the same, so that what you are pointing out is what's the performance of this file system. So you can ask what's the performance for sequential access, and you can ask what's the performance for random access. Okay, so say you want to do random access, you want the third block of the file, which is this block. What kind of performance do you see? Yep. It's linear in the number of blocks. It's a linked list. There's no way for you to jump there directly. You have to start here and follow this chain. You have to read the first block, okay, read the chain, read the next block until you get here. So to get to the nth block, you will have to do n disk IOs. Okay, because the entry is for the next block is stored in the previous block. So you have to read this block whether you want or not. Okay, so random access is going to be bad in this linked list organization, because you always have to search linearly through this linked list until you go or get to the block you care about. Okay? Now think in terms of magnetic disks. Okay? each of these accesses will incur a seek and a rotational latency. Yeah, because these blocks are scattered everywhere, you'll just go to the first block, read it, find the address of the next block, then you'll do a seek to that block, read that block, and so on. Okay. So to get to the ith block, you have I seeks, disk seeks, I rotational latency, okay, which means even slower. Okay, so first of all, performance is linear and you need to do a linear search. And second, for each of these IOs, you will incur a seek and a rotational latency. Advantage is, of course, that the file can grow arbitrarily. There is no problem, because you want to add more blocks, you just find some free blocks here, okay, take their address, you stick it here, okay, then you added a block, and so on. Any other comments on this? What other things can we say about this organization? Yep.
Well, since you can add on fragmentation.
Yes. So in this case, it should be clear that your fragmentation problem is gone. Okay, because you are handing out disk space in granularity of fixed size blocks. Okay. And any free block can be used for any file. So there's no real fragmentation involved. Okay. If you free up, you delete a file, a set of blocks will be free. Okay, now you can take any of those blocks and assign it to a new file or a file that is growing. Okay, so no fragmentation. Unlike in contiguous allocation. Is that clear? Now it's interesting to keep in mind that the free block list, which I didn't mention until now, okay, I did say that there are two data structures that the operating or the file system has to maintain, the free block list and the file descriptor. In this case also the file descriptor is simple. It just stores the number of blocks in the file and it stores a pointer to the first block in the file. That's a simple descriptor. But the free block list, it's also interesting. Free block list can also be a similar linked list. Yeah, the free block list, think of the free block list of as a file that looks exactly like this, but all the blocks on this file, that is really the free block list, are all the blocks that are not allocated to any actual file. Okay. So file deletion is very simple. If you want to delete this file, all you will do is you will take this entire chain and you will add it to the end of the free block list. Okay, so all these blocks get freed up. You don't have to go and do anything. Okay, you want to allocate a block, you just go to the head of the free block list, take a block and assign it to whatever file you want. Okay, is that clear? Okay. So, since DOS was one of the early file systems that used this, you can, if you have actually played with DOS, you will realize what it was doing when your file system gets corrupt for some reason. Okay. You can go and reconstruct files because you just have to find chains that are not assigned to any files and say this is a file that I have just recovered from this disk, from this block, or rather from the disk. Okay, so when you are writing, for instance, if this pointer gets corrupt, okay, the data is still there, you just have to go and say, are there some blocks that neither belong to the free block list nor do they belong to any existing block. So then you found a chain that might actually contain valid data. So this is how you can go and reconstruct deleted or corrupt files from your file system. Okay, so we talked about advantages. Fragmentation is gone. File sizes, files can grow and shrink. Okay, efficiently support sequential access. Okay, does not support random access well, because every random access is a linear seek. And the number of seek depends on which block you are accessing. Ith block means I seeks. Okay, example is a DOS. Okay, so now we will talk about more sophisticated data structure. So in this case, we will assume that you are not allocating data contiguously, okay, but that you want to still do efficient random access. Okay, what happened here was random access was not great, the performance. Okay, so how do you do that? You use an indexed organization for your file descriptor. Okay, so this is essentially equivalent to a page table. So in this descriptor, you have an entry for each block. If you have I blocks, you will have I entries here. Okay? And each of this basically points to where the data is stored. Okay, so here, okay, so this is your file descriptor. This thing is actually stored here. So this will point to, so this has the address, so you have the sector number, the platter and so on. Okay, so essentially it's an array. So if you want to, so what you do is when you open the file, initially you read the file descriptor, you store it in memory. Okay? At this point, if you want to access the ith block, you just look up the ith entry in this file descriptor. Okay, so it's like an array access. You get the address and then you go and read that block. Okay, so this is how you have now made random access more efficient. Okay, by essentially keeping an index. So this is an index structure. Okay, you can index into any of the blocks of the file because this is essentially stored separate from the data itself. Okay, is this clear? Okay, so now it's what about sequential access? Yep. Right. Yes. So sequential access basically says you look up this entry, read the first block. You look up the next entry, read the next block, and so on. And if these blocks are scattered over disk, because we no longer require them to be contiguous, sequential access will require iSeqs, okay, as was just pointed out. Okay, so in the contiguous allocation, sequential access had one seek. Okay, both in the linked list organization and the index organization, sequential access requires iSeqs, okay, to read I blocks. Okay. Random access is efficient because you can just go look up the entry and go read it. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so let's look at the advantages. So no fragmentation again. Okay. Both sequential and random access are easy. Okay. Sequential is not as efficient as contiguous allocation, but nevertheless you can support it well. Okay, for each block you will access, you will have one seek. Okay. Disadvantage is there is a limit on the file size. Okay, and this is what says lots of seek because data is not contiguous. Okay, why is there a limit on the file size? Right. So the limit on the file size, it depends on how much space you have allocated for the file descriptor. Okay. There are some entries here. Okay. This descriptor is actually, as I was mentioning, is stored on a fixed location on disk. It's in the initial part of the disk. Each file descriptor will have a fixed size. File descriptors themselves cannot grow or shrink. Files can grow or shrink. So what that means is you have to decide what's the maximum size you care about and create a file descriptor of that size. Maybe only two entries are used there if the file has only two blocks. So all of these are empty. Okay? But depending on how many entries you use, if there are 100 entries here, then you can, a file will have 100 blocks and no more because you can't grow the file descriptor in this case. Okay, your question.
Doesn't the file descriptor only have like a
Doesn't the file descriptor have a description of, yes, that this is exactly what it is telling you, where the blocks of the file are stored. Right? So it says block 1 is stored at this disk address, block disk 2 is stored at this disk address.
For each block of the file?
For each block of the file. So there is this part of the file stores other things like what's the owner, who's the owner of the file, how many blocks are there, what are the read, write, execute bits, all of that is stored here. Okay? And then this is pointers to the data of the file. So file descriptor has all of the information about the file, okay, who the file belongs to, what is the access permissions on the file, as well as what are the data, address of where the file is stored, data blocks are stored. Yes.
Since the file descriptors are also stored on this, how are they accessed? How do you get quick
access? Okay, that's a good question. File descriptors are stored on disk, how are they accessed? So clearly there is going to be at least one disk access, at least, okay, it may be more. Okay. Typically file descriptors are stored at a known location on disk. Okay, that's basically in the super block. So if you say each file descriptor, I'm just going to make up a number, okay, has 128 bytes. Okay. So file descript, so this is where the all the file descriptors are 128 bytes, 128 bytes, and so on. So this is why I was saying last time that files are numbered. Yeah, as far as internally a file is concerned, it has a unique number. That number maps to which file descriptor entry do you care about. If this is the file has number 10, you basically look up the 10th entry in this list of file descriptors. Okay? And because then you don't need any other information, you just know this is a fixed size. So if they are a 128 size, that's the offset. 1280 is the byte offset where the file descriptor for file number 10 is stored. Okay, so what you basically do is you do a directory lookup. Okay, the directory is basically a string that maps the name of the file to the number of the file. Okay, so once you do a directory lookup, you say this is file I. Okay, then you go and look up the ith entry in the list of file descriptors here. Each file descriptor is of a fixed size, so you know exactly where that is going to be stored. Okay, you basically do the size of the file descriptor times I, that's the byte offset. Okay, and then you read that data from that disk block, and then you have it in memory. That's basically what this is. Okay, that's the translation the file system has to do. As you can see, file descriptors have to be stored at a known location, otherwise you will have to have an index to first figure out where the file descriptor is stored, okay, not just where the data of the file is stored. So typically metadata is stored at a known location. Data can be stored anywhere. Okay, is that clear? Yes, question.
File descriptors always fixed size.
Okay. So question is, file descriptors, are they a fixed size? In this organization, it's a fixed size. We'll now relax that assumption in the next organization. Okay. They have to be of fixed. The reason it's advantageous to make them a fixed size is that this lookup, saying where is the file descriptor for file I, that becomes just a calculation that the file system has to do. Just take the file number and you multiply it by the file descriptor size. If they're a fixed size, then you know that's where the file descriptor is stored. If they are all of arbitrary size, if one is 10 bytes, another is 12 bytes, you will need another directory to tell you where the file descriptor is stored. Because they are now of different size, you cannot figure out where it is going to be stored. Okay, I have to, the file descriptor. So typically most file systems will assume they are of fixed size. Okay. And if they are of fixed size and you actually store the pointers in the file descriptor itself, then you will have a limit on the number of blocks you can store for that file. That depends on the size of the file descriptor and how many entries you can have. Okay. So this is a problem. So we've solved the fragmentation problem. Okay. From contiguous allocation, we sort of said, okay, we now made sequential linked lists at good sequential but not good random access. We solved that problem. Okay. But we have now stuck with this problem, okay, which is maximum file that we don't want it to be small. Okay, there can be a limit, but we want it to be very, very large. So for most practical files, that's not an issue at all. Okay, this problem we will not be able to solve, because if you go back to contiguous allocation, you have fragmentation. Okay, so this will stay, but we'll try to relax this. Okay, and that is basically, we will use now what is called a multi-level index structure to store your file. Okay, so this is basically now your file descriptor. Okay, that I showed you previously. So there is something here which says the name of the user and whatnot. And then there are some pointers like before. Okay. In this case, there are 14 pointers. Okay, exactly 14 pointers in your file descriptor. Okay, they are this. So first, 12 pointers directly point to data blocks like before. Okay, so these two, the first 12 entries here are exactly like this. Okay, they just have addresses of data blocks, and first 12 blocks you just look up the file descriptor, you know where the data is. Okay. 13th entry is actually an indirect pointer. It itself points to a block. Okay, this is a disk block, and all of these entries themselves then point to data block. So there's one level of indirection you added. To access the 13th disk block, okay, you have to first read this entry. Go read this disk block, which can be anywhere on disk. Okay, this is not really stored in the file descriptor part of the disk. It's actually stored where the data is stored. Okay, so you read this block, and then you have about 1024 entries here. Okay. So now, if you have more than 12 plus 1024 blocks in your file, Okay? You then go and access the 14th entry here. Okay? Because until here you could have 12 blocks and then your file can grow another 1024 blocks for this. But if it grows beyond that size, then you basically go into what is called double indirect. So in this case, you will allocate a disk block. Each entry here, each of the 1024 entries here point to another block, and each of those actually point to data blocks of the file. Okay? So that gives you the ability to grow another 1024 square blocks. Okay, so what has this done for us? If most files are small, remember we said most files are small. Okay? Most files are small, they are going to have fewer than 12 blocks. Okay, 12 blocks is already 48 kilobytes. So then you can just access a file descriptor and access the blocks of that file efficiently just by looking up the file descriptor. Okay? As the file grows, we will progressively make the access to the data slower and slower by adding multiple levels of indirection. Okay. The file grows beyond 12 blocks, we will add a single indirect block. So to access these blocks, you have to do two disk accesses. You have to first read this file descriptor, then you have to read this disk block, and then you have addresses of the actual data of the file. Okay. If the file grows beyond 12 plus 1024, which is grows beyond 1036 blocks, then we will have two levels of indirection. Okay. We will basically read that entry, first read this block, read that entry, then read this disk block. That has another 1024 entries, and you will read one of these two, or there are 1024 of these. Okay? Now most modern file system actually add a 15th entry here, which has three levels of indirect. That's called triple indirect. Okay? That gives you the ability for the file to grow to another 1024 cube. Okay? This is the Unix organization of how it stores files. This is referred to as an index node. The file descriptor is referred to as an index node or the inode. Here this is still a fixed size. It's stored in this location on disk. But what it points to can be arbitrarily large. The index can be arbitrarily large. In fact, as large as this. Okay, that many entries. Okay, so now we relax the problem of file has a limit that we need to worry about. Okay, because this limit is actually very large. You can store 1024 cube blocks. Okay, each block could be of 4K. Okay, so that's a lot of bytes that you can store. Is that clear? Any questions on this? Yeah, last question. Sorry, what's the question? This part of the index block stores in the data part of the disk. This is stored in the well-known location. The inodes are always stored in the super block. Okay? The inodes will actually point to single, double, indirect block. Those are actually stored in the data part along with the files themselves. Okay? Okay, so we are going to stop here, and then I will, if you did not pick up your exam, I have it here. Okay, so let's just come back.